This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
Oh, good morning. WRFL Lexington here. How are you? This is Mick, and it's a little bit after 7. I'm unexpectedly awake. You might think, but Mick, you do a radio show every week at 7. And then if you listen regularly, you might think, wow, you're unexpectedly awake. And that's because I walked. And I'm just going to toot my own horn a little bit on that. I'm pretty happy about it. Beautiful day outside. Beautiful, beautiful day. Although I got to say, I'm not yet thrilled, you know, with this is going to sound pretty bad. I'm not yet thrilled with the sound because we've been, you know, like sleeping with our windows open and fans and stuff. And it's really nice. But message to Mick to birds. Could you just kind of keep it down for just a little bit longer? Because the birds in our neighborhood anyway are just like a little extra chipper and chirper. So they start, you know, the chirping starts happening while it's still quite dark outside. But it's like this, you know, this cue that you're like, okay, it's definitely going to get light here in a minute. Because then birds don't lie. It, you know, so beyond that, everything's great. Music, I was inspired by Charlie, who was on before me, who is incidentally WRFL's wonderful programming director. Oh, wow, this is amazing. I've made a discovery. So Charlie was playing something when I left that I really liked, and it was just in the CD player, so I didn't bother to look. But it inspired me. It inspired me to play something from the soundtrack to the amazing movie that Lucy Jones brought to town about the history of Cambodian popular music called Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll. And so I pulled just now the CD out of the CD player to see what Charlie had played before me so that I didn't sound like a complete idiot who was just like, and something else before that. And what I pull out of the CD player is Don't Think I've Forgotten, Cambodia's Lost Rock and Roll. The same album that I picked a track off of. So now at this point, I don't know what track she played, but I will tell you that I played a track that is extremely appropriate and timely to Lexington's wonderful up and rising cultural scene. And that track is called Shave Your Beard. Okay. That's just the name of the track. I mean, I don't know. I picked it too. So, and it was by, who was that by? I can't really pronounce their name. I apologize. Ross Sarisota, I think is how you say his name. That movie, by the way, is absolutely incredible. If you ever get a chance to see it, and you've ever heard, if you're older and you are embarrassed, so you still don't really understand what happened in Vietnam with the Vietnam War, this movie explains it pretty well. If you're younger and you've just heard that there was some kind of fighting thing that happened in Vietnam and Cambodia in the 70s, this movie explains it to you. It's very complicated, but the movie Don't Think I've Forgotten does an incredible job of explaining what happened in Vietnam vis-a-vis, I don't know if that's the right term, but I'm always trying to use vis-a-vis, the Cambodian popular, the thriving Cambodia popular and rock, music and rock and roll scene. So there's like a really long endorsement for that. That's what I have for you. Also, let's see, I have a good show coming up. This is Trivial Thursdays on WRFL, and it's a little bit after 7 in the a.m. We are going to, you know, let's see. I think I'm going to play another song off that soundtrack because it's so great. And then I'm going to come back and visit with Jack King, who is going to talk some about the impending bouts that mark the beginning of the season 4, the assortment of roller derby teams that. Call Lexington home. So that's very exciting. Won't you stick around? Other great stuff coming up too. Leif Erickson, I think, is going to be around to run his mouth some more. Leif was here last week, and you know, for a long time, I've tried to have co-hosts. Kind of, I usually defer to a female co-host because it just seems like it would be more edifying than two dudes sitting around. But Leif is making me reconsider that. So hopefully Leif will make it in, and we'll get to hear the many, many words that Leif Erickson has to say about just about anything. So won't you stick around? There's more to come. We'll be on until 9 a.m. This is Trivial Thursdays on WRFL. Roller Derby saved my soul. A popular choice, though not the only choice, when it comes to roller derby. My friend Jack King is here. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Mick. How's it going?
How about if I turn your mic on? Let's try again. Okay, yeah. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Mick.
That was Uncle Leon. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of these days, Uncle Leon's going to come play, right?
Well, you know what?
Has he?
I've actually seen Uncle Leon play up in Florence. He regularly plays the end of season party for the Black and Bluegrass Roller Girls up there.
I was just thinking, I wonder how many benefit gigs he's been asked to play for roller derby.
A lot.
Like, all of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's just say he's probably not hurting for money due to that one song.
So where does the spirit of that song, from whence does the spirit of that song spring where you and your world here are concerned?
Oh, well, I mean, that, I think it's that song, you know, it kind of speaks to the originating spirit behind roller derby, sort of the tough girl feeling.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we've sort of expanded that into a whole lot more into, you know, kids and men's and everything else. So
we were talking about what do you call so Lexington here in the last how many years?
Well,
since the
Rock's been around since 2007, okay, so nine years.
So since 2007, in the last decade, we'll mm-hmm. say, just mm-hmm. to sound extra venerable.
Sounds super neat.
You guys have rolled out. I really hate doing that, but I had to do it. At this point, three teams now, right?
That is correct. We've got the Roller Girls of Central Kentucky, or Rock. And we have then came the juniors team, which is Central Kentucky Junior Roller Derby. We usually go by the team name on that one, which is the Sixth Street Slammers, due to practicing in the warehouse behind Sixth Street Brewing. And then the Men's Roller Derby of Kentucky, and the team name for that one is the Dark Horses.
This is the newest one, right? The men's team?
That's correct. Yeah, the men's team. I always tell people this story. The men's team started because the juniors team, I was coaching the juniors team, and I coached them for about 2 years when they very first started. And I saw how great the kids were getting, and I grabbed some people and I said, listen, you know, if we want to play on a men's team, we've got to start right now because the kids are so amazing that, you know, if we wait 3 or 4 more years, then these kids are going to start aging up and everyone is going to be, you know, what we think of now as a top level athlete. Like, mm-hmm. there's a skater named Bonnie Thunders, and she's, you know, cited as like sort of the LeBron James of roller derby, which would probably mean more to me if I really like knew much about LeBron James.
Oh, good. We're
yeah.
in the same.
Yeah, I don't.
We're in the same boat there. Good.
So, but anyway, she, you know, I was like, everybody's going to be a Bonnie Thunders in 6 or 7 years. And so I told the guys, I said, we've got to get this happening like right now, or I'm not going to be able to play. I'm going to be too old. So.
Interesting. Yep. So, and then, so what kind of interest have you had from the dude quadrant?
You know, honestly, in the last 6 months, we've picked up a bunch of new guys. It's really taken off, and you know, we're going on about 2.5 years now. So, mm-hmm. so this is kind of when we're, excuse me, this is when we're kind of picking up steam, and we saw that happen with juniors and with the women's team as well. It takes a couple of years to sort of get the idea out there, and then friends start bringing friends. And that
was that the way it was with the original group? Were you in, or have you been involved since the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I have. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think it's like that. I think that people get involved, and then they slowly oh, you know, they bring a friend in or they meet somebody at work that has skated when they were a kid and they bring them in. And it just takes a little while to sort of perpetuate out. But I think finally Lexington's getting to the point where when people say Derby, that maybe horses aren't the first thing.
Okay.
That's my dream. That's my dream.
Jack King here from, again, I'm not sure what to say you're from.
Men's team, just say roller derby.
Yeah,
I'm from roller derby.
Lexington roller derby.
It's like you come from music.
You,
you're just born of music.
You've got, so you guys, let's see. So everyone can get a giant dose of this on Saturday?
Yes, that's
is correct. This still, where does it happen these days?
It happens right next to Rupp Arena. It's going to happen in the Lexington Convention Center. And it's just going to be a full day experience for people.
That's pretty cool because I've been a couple times and it has a real kind of social quality to it. I mean, sometimes everybody's attention is all focused on the track, and then other times there's meander time for the snack bar or hanging around and talking or whatever. So, I mean, that sounds like a great opportunity in some ways for just to hang out in the world of roller derby a little bit.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the big things that happens, you know, when you're at bouts, it's kind of like a big family reunion because people travel to watch, you know, particularly people that are interested in roller derby will come to Lexington to watch, particularly an event this big. This is the first time all three teams have played on the same day. So we had a couple doubleheaders with the women's team and the juniors team last year and the women's team and the men's team last year. But this is the first time ever we've had all three teams playing on the same day. So it'll be a big experience, and we expect a lot of roller derby fans from around the area to come. And it, like I said, it becomes kind of like a family reunion. You see people you maybe haven't seen in a year or so and get to socialize a little bit in between. So. Well,
it sounds like a fiasco, if you ask me. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. Jack King's here from the world of Lexington roller derby. Let's take a little musical break because I want to play Jim Croce and his great song from way back in when. This is Roller Derby Queen from Jim Croce, and we will be back. Jim Croce there with Roller Derby Queen. Back with Jack King from the Lexington roller derby scene, and joined by Leif Erickson.
Greetings.
Good morning, Leif.
Good morning.
We talking about Errol's big doings this Saturday, but of which Leif and I both participated as members.
I don't
like
to talk about my big doings on the air.
Well, it's not, I'm not sure that it's even legal, like so many things, but. We've played there with March Madness marching band before,
and that's always one of our favorite things. One of particularly the junior team, they really enjoy March Madness being at Derby.
Yeah, so like one, I'm always fascinated by. Are you all still in the business of the incredible sacred geometry of putting the track down and everything? I don't see how you couldn't be.
Oh yeah,
I want you to talk about it a little bit because it's so. I like details, and that is always super fascinating to me.
The track laying is actually one of those things. The men's team, we actually have a couple of guys that are carpenters on the men's team. And the first time one of them, his name's Grizzly Smashums.
Of course it is.
he saw us lay the track, and he goes, "This is ridiculous. You guys, this is, you know, you're doing this so hard and so wrong."
Oh.
So he went home, and he built sort of a track-laying device and, you know, got some wood, put some screws into the right place, hooked some rope, and measured it all out correctly. And so now what used to take us quite a while, we can get the track. It used to take over an hour to get the track just laid, and you know, what it ends up being is, you know, sort of an oblong, rectangular shape, you know.
Well, it's racetrack shaped.
Right,
if
exactly.
I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. But it's tilted a little bit, like the inside.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So actually, what people don't realize is in the straightaways, one end of the straightaway is a little bit wider than the other. So think of the outside as being like a normal, like oblong racetrack, and the inside is as well, except it's tilted just about 6 inches.
How's come?
You know what? I wish I could tell
it's been lost to posterity. It's just a tradition.
I thought I could never do this because I can't skate, but it turns out there's geometry required too. This
massive geometry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who put any of us in charge of any of this kind of mess.
But so I'd love to see that. So that tool is like this kind of like, it's like a sextant for roller derby.
It's exactly what it is. And we told him he should probably get in the business of selling it because there's a lot of teams out there that spend a lot of time laying track.
But it's totally geometry, just to be clear.
Oh, like, yeah.
If you were looking for something like, you know, if you've ever had a math teacher in high school that was like, you'll appreciate this later in life. And it's like, yeah, if you're in roller derby, you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Would that count as formal or informal geometry? And I've never understood, do you wear a tux to formal geometry? I showed up like that once and the teacher didn't appreciate it.
Well, they're
what kind of teacher wouldn't appreciate that?
Exactly. Well, I think
I've asked you to wear a tux to my work
and not understanding and writing short stories during class instead of paying attention.
I can't seem to get you to wear a tuxedo to this show to save my life.
I'm completely naked right now.
I wasn't going to say anything because just it's awkward for all of us, really.
It is.
Can you be
awkward.
Like uncompletely naked? Is it like naked or not naked? I don't think you can be degrees of naked, really. Probably.
He's starting to get coffee in him. Look out.
Yeah, say. So, we're all getting our morning caffeine in.
So, like, okay, so talk a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of hilarious. The roller derby is simultaneously, it seems like it's full of camaraderie and community, and yet, from a terminology standpoint, it's littered with violence.
That is absolutely the case.
All the names, some of the names.
Oh yeah. I mean,
it's a funny. Like, maybe it's just this big smirky thing.
It is. I was on ABC 36 doing a promo yesterday, and the little like tagline they posted is something like, "Bring your aggression and your snark." and I was like, well, I mean, I guess that's appropriate. It's littered with a lot of aggression, but yeah, the camaraderie is a big thing. I've heard a lot of people liken it to rugby, that, you know, you go out there and you beat the crap out of each other for, you know, an hour or so, and then you know, for the adults, you go drink a beer, or for the kids, you go eat some pizza, and you hang out and you compare bruises and you talk about, you know, what you did well. And you know, for instance, I'm real excited. A guy who actually broke his leg last year is going to be skating again with the team that we're opposing, and I'm real excited to see him back on the track because I too had a broken leg and had fought through that battle. So we've talked online quite a bit, and I'm real excited for him to come and for us to knock around some more.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you have any place for people with bad knees who cry easily? Because I might join this.
You know, as a matter of fact, we do.
All right.
I'm in. We call those NSOs, or non-skating officials.
Ah.
So, which is an integral part of the game. So, I mean, if you can skate and you really like minutiae, then referees are what you – that's the name of the game. You want to be a referee, then you better like – really minute details of rules. And
I'd be way too distracted looking at the women to actually pay attention to what I'm supposed to be calling.
Yeah, well, and let me tell you, it is very distracting, just the action of it all. But refereeing,
I'm talking about.
Sit down, boy.
Incorrigible.
Awkward. But NSOing is a super important part of the whole thing, and those are the people that keep the score, keep the penalties, time the penalty box.
What I'm thinking though is you can't just like I can't just be the guy that gets to come in and go, so and so is the lead jammer, right?
Let's
talk about that a little bit, because who gets to do that?
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, actually, we had an announcer drop out, so we do have an opening for announcing.
Oh, no.
We were actually just looking for someone for the junior spout and the men's spout. But I mean, we actually have one of our junior dads who has been, as we call, voluntold that he's going to.
That's a seriously rich and deep term for American society. And children, yeah. And child rearing.
Yeah, well, you know, your kid's gonna play. You've got to help out. So he play. He used to play in a band, so he's being voluntold that he's announcing, and so it's going to be. This is his first time announcing for the bout. So
do you have any? So do you have any kind of like? So the main. Let me just. No, I shouldn't say that. Well, I'm going to say it anyway. So I mean, like you're all the showcase in a lot of ways. Is no offense to the men or the kids, but the Roller Girls of Central Kentucky, they're kind of the original. They're
oh, absolutely.
And so, like, I don't know if they're the headliners or whatever, but
well, yeah, they're putting it on. It's really their ball game that we're all showing up to. So we all are very thankful. They have become such an established team and really have their stuff together. Their team has just grown by leaps and bounds over the last year or two. So we now, you know, have the opportunity to all get together in the same place and pitch in all together. I mean, you'll see pretty much all of us through the day are going to be rotating through. So I'm coaching the juniors first, which starts at 3. And then I turn around and like 10 minutes after the juniors get finished, I have to put on gear and skate in the men's bout and then gear down and 10 minutes later be NSOing for the women's bout. So it's
how much. So what do people need to know anything if they come to see a roller derby bout? I know I've always been like, you know, and I probably we don't get it, want to get confused with the rules, but because it's a lot of fun just to watch. But what's the simplest explanation for what on earth is happening out there?
The simplest explanation is there are 5 skaters from each team on the track at a time, 4 blockers or basically defensive players, 1 person who's a jammer or the person who scores. The jammer wears a star on their helmet. It's actually a cover for the helmet that we call panty. It's called a panty in men's as well.
He looked at me when he said that. I guess he thought I was going to comment.
Well,
I'm a very calm person who never makes any kind of innuendo.
Never. Never.
So I don't know why you looked at me. I'm kind of taken aback by that. Panties. Go ahead. You were talking about panties.
I can see you're taking notes. So the jammers have the star on their jammer panty, as we call it, on their helmet. And the whistle blows, all 10 skaters start skating. The jammers sort of fight to get through the pack, not like with punches, but, you know, with their body. And the first one to get through...
Like, they call it checking, right?
Yeah.
They like hip check each other or something like
exactly,
that?
Exactly. Hip checks, shoulder checks.
Checks mix.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's delicious. We keep it
which means in the parlance of my 4-year-old daughter, which means to crash into one another.
That's probably the
quit
better.
Crashing. That's what she says to me. Quit crashing into me.
Are you training LL to be a roller girl?
Maybe.
We'll awesome. I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
Junior's team starts at 8, so 8 years old.
You right.
Bring her out. So the jammers go around and the first lap. Whichever one gets out first is lead jammer. Then on the second pass through for every opposing skater that a jammer passes, they get 1 point. So the lead jammer can call off the jam by tapping their hips anytime. What I like to tell people is it's one of the few sports where offense and defense are played at the same time and both teams can score simultaneously. So think of basketball if basketball had 2 balls on the court. And think of how like, I'm waiting for the innuendo now. Come on.
I'm still writing about the panties. I haven't finished this about a panty. Excuse me.
But, you know, the sort of hectic, the frantic nature of offense and defense at the same time. And
yeah.
So it's pretty exciting. I mean, there's a lot going on out there.
So we haven't mentioned who's coming to town. Is it a unified team coming to town or several teams coming to town?
Several teams.
Since you've got 3, you guys have 3 teams on the track.
Mm-hmm. So the women's team is playing Southern Illinois Roller Girls, which is a team that the Roller Girls of Central Kentucky have been friends with for years and years and years. The men's team is playing basically the men's team from there, which is the Brigade of Handsome Gentlemen. Yeah. I told him, I'm like, guys, really, you're like really kind of a 6. You're not really, I wouldn't put you at like an 8. You're like a 6 on the handsome scale.
On the handsome gentleman scale.
Exactly. Okay.
Maybe they meant they like handsome cabs.
It could be. Well, but they do have some very fine mustaches there. There's some really well managed.
Do those help with the strategies at all? Or is that
maybe aerodynamics? I don't. Okay. I'm not sure. But and then the juniors team is playing a team from Alabama, the Montgomery County Minions, and this is their second bout of all, ever. So
I'm wondering if dudes who just have a higher level of testosterone. I wonder if things. I don't even know how to say this really, but like. I could imagine a bunch of dudes playing roller derby and getting a lot meaner, kind of. Is that just complete fallacy or what? Completely out of their own control, basically.
The physicality is, I'm not going to say the physicality is higher, but just the masses are larger, the speed. We tend not
reptile
to be...
Reptile brains, the reptile
Oh,
brains.
Absolutely. It's funny. I mean, there's a lot more, a lot more testosterone, and a lot more just sort of, I think women get out there and it's sort of an outlet for aggression, and men sort of get that outlet for aggression, just in sports in general. So when the men get out there, then it just becomes much more physical, just a lot more body slant. We've got a guy who it's going to be his first bout that we're real excited about. Legs Benedict, he's one of our new guys that we're real excited about, and he's built kind of like a rectangle. He's an ex power lifter, dude's.
Do you have to have special skates or what? Reinforced skates?
No,
truck tires.
We do have a guy that wears size 14, and we're trying desperately to get him some. Special skates because his are just so long,
it's yawning under that.
We feel like we're gonna get the Carpenters to reinforce them or something. I don't know,
like the band the Carpenters. I think a couple of them are dead, but
that's a good idea.
They're probably a still touring.
Well, so Saturday, you guys having a big day?
Yeah,
starts at 2, right?
Doors open at 2. The juniors bout starts at 3. And then it's every 2 hours after that. Junior bout at 3, men's bout at 5, women's bout at 7.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is all downtown at the Civic Center? No, right. Do they call it that anymore, the Lexington Center?
No, not.
Something, what do they call it?
Way to date yourself, man.
So if you,
it's my specialty.
Do people get to choose their own names, or is there some clearinghouse? My wife says she wanted to be Payne Austin if she ever...
Well, there used to be a site that was called Two Evils. That had a registry, but that was way in the early days. And as you can guess, when there were like 20 teams, it was easy to have like a name that was unique. But people are just, if you think you're creative, sometimes you're just not. And
what about Furnace Hemingway? Somebody can have that one, Furnace Hemingway, or Killam Faulkner. I've got them.
I'm going to take notes now.
Nerds will absolutely go crazy in the stands at Killam Faulkner.
I'm always for the juniors team. I had to put the kibosh on because we had too many Harry Potter names coming up. So we've got a Voldemort, a J.K. Rowling.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, that's it. No more. And now we've got a bunch of people who...
The collective, I heard going up a few weeks
completely.
Ago.
Completely. Now we have too many people who have started with the name Dark. I've got a girl named Allie who's Dark Allie, which I like that one.
Not bad.
We've got a new girl that just started, Dark Pegasus, and then Dark Allie's brother just started. So we actually just started having boys on the junior team as well. We haven't started playing co-ed games yet, but we do have some boys that are skating now. And so that's really exciting for us to have opened that door for young boys to get in as well.
Okay, so next time you come visit, you're going to bring some of these hoodlums, right?
Yeah, I was going to bring them today, but they're testing in school.
I always love having we've had some of the kids on a number of times.
Yeah, Bruising Bell, Terror Dactyl. She's really funny with the puns. If anybody says anything's terrible, she goes, "You mean terrible?" It's just so bad.
They came. A couple of them came up and said hi to me not too long ago at some out in public social event, and I felt like the coolest person there because they they came over specifically just to say hi to me. So I know roller derby people.
Yeah, I know. Well, you're cool like that, Nick.
Kids. Jack, thanks for coming and visiting.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Probably see you on Saturday.
Oh yeah.
So. You guys have a big day, and best wishes to all of the skaters.
I've got a tip for you. Mm-hmm. Instead of wood for the track, why don't you use, like, at the playgrounds where they use recycled tires? Use that stuff. It'll make the game much more interesting. People will be falling and hurting themselves. And that's what people want to see.
Oh, well.
Like at a hockey game.
There's a type called Renegade that we can talk about sometime. That's it's something that, no one that I care about should ever play. But
and it's something that you guys always try to downplay, which is why we want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. But those people play on parking lots and in concrete. Oh. And they kind of look like hamburger when they're done. It's
I was going to say
gross.
The goal is to kind of get hurt as much as possible.
Yeah,
kind
that's
of thing.
Pretty much what it looks like.
Which is not what you guys do.
No. We have rules. We have rules for a reason, and it's called safety. So,
Pet Shop Boys on request there with from their new record, Super, with Undertow, the track there.
Among the phrases you thought you would never hear, new Pet Shop Boys.
Well, there you have it. You know, some people, that's kind of their jam, Leaf.
Oh, I mean, no disrespect. I had no idea, that's all. But, you know.
Maybe wrong side of the Atlantic. It's possible.
To quote Pet Shakespeare.
Big, big stars in England for 30 years.
Yeah, to quote Shakespeare, there are more Pet Shop Boy songs in this world than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Leaf. That's a paraphrase.
I guess it is. Or did the term Pet Shop Boys come from?
Well, Shakespeare coined Pet Shop Boys. It was in King Lear Part 3.
There's a coin with the Pet Shop Boys on him?
Yeah, yes. And in King Lear Part 3, Lear is actually dead, and they take him around the beach pretending he's alive. It's kind of that's where Weekend at Bernie's got their stuff.
Right.
You didn't know it had such a pedigree, but
God, I didn't.
Not everyone can.
That's part of the reason we have you on the show, Leif Erickson here. For a return visit, because somehow, in some universe, we decided that Leif hadn't gotten to say enough last week.
It was all the peyote we did last time. You forgot what happened, actually. So,
if I could operate the equipment in that condition, that's what keeps me sober. Operating this equipment.
I thought you meant peyote keeps you sober.
That would be interesting. That's a nice bumper sticker there.
I mean, what are you counterbalancing with peyote? Wow, what is it that needs to be evened out by a peyote? That would be interesting.
So, Leif, in our short time apart, mm-hmm. What's been going on?
I missed you terribly, first
yeah,
of all.
Right.
Yeah. I just finished up grading for the semester, which means the angry emails are rolling in.
Oh, right. From students or parents?
Yeah,
or both?
Students. Well, parents.
What about parents? Are there some cases where parents will still email you about their college,
yes.
their college student?
But you know what the beautiful, wonderful, absolutely great thing is?
You're a teacher, and so you don't answer them.
Well, I can't. Actually, I'm not allowed to because of federal education right to privacy laws. I can't.
What?
Yeah, I can't. If your child is over 18, I have to have written permission from them to discuss
your grades.
Oh, you
mean you can't answer the helicopter parents'
exactly.
Email.
Which is glorious. I just can say law says I cannot answer you unless you get permission from your child, and that rarely. I think it's happened once. Although I do have students sometimes come in for advising with their parents.
Uh-huh.
So that's
really?
A bit awkward.
College students. We're
yes.
talking about college students here.
Yes.
Let's be clear.
Yes, college students. Exactly. And then I'm getting these emails. Why did I get a D in your class? And I want to say because I'm a gentleman. That's why you got a D. Because you really have to try to fail in my class.
Uh-huh.
And just basically not turn things in. And there are people occasionally who just really struggle and don't make the grade. But
what's their if someone got a D and they're like, why did I get a D? What do you think their rationale is? Like why
the Dunning-Kruger effect? Have you heard of that?
No,
that's a psychological effect whereby people think that they're better at things than they are. But humans tend to overestimate our ability. For instance, the Dunning-Kruger.
But when you get to college, isn't that supposed to change?
Oh no, it's a no, it gets worse, actually. It gets worse when people think, I can turn in three major papers in the last week, and they're going to be well-written and get good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they have to be. They just have to be.
They have to be, because they mean it. They're taking Adderall. I mean, what else do you need to write a good paper in less than an hour that you were supposed to be working on for weeks? I mean, it seems reasonable, right? Well, you know, like the Dunning-Kruger effect,
yeah.
For instance, one of the biggest examples used for that is that everybody thinks they're above-average drivers, which is not possible, of course, because by any given metric, 50% of the people you know are at or below average. So not everybody can be above average as a driver. And yet surveys show that most people think they're above average drivers. which is simply mathematically not possible.
Well, George Carlin, you probably love his routine on this, right, from years ago?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember which routine you're talking about, but it's
George Carlin. He always had the thing that was like, you're driving down the road, and anyone that passes you is a maniac.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone that's going slower than you is an idiot.
Yes. Yes, Walker Percy says that, you know, I am at once the most selfless, giving person I know and the world's greatest, well, butthole. I'll edit for the radio. But they're both true at the same time. And when the person passes us, we think, what a jerk that person is, just going around the world, just flaunting their jerkiness. But when I'm in a big hurry, it's like, I have a reason, you know, that there are reasons for the things I do. I'm a reasonable person, and I just happen to be in a hurry. But when that guy's in a hurry, what a misanthrope that guy is. Ew.
I have a new kind of philosophy that's hard to explain, and probably I shouldn't even bring it up, but when it comes to driving, I was forever changed by riding motorcycles in Vietnam and watching how they drive, basically.
Wow.
Which most people would think is just completely insane. There's not really any rules. Everybody just kind of tries to go where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. It works in some way that's inexplicable. Basically, the god of all gods there where traffic is concerned is the flow. So it's just like, whatever you do, two things. One, don't run into the person in front of you. If everyone does this, we're all fine.
Right.
And then the second thing is, don't interfere with the flow. Just like, keep moving. So a lot of people do this thing in American traffic where they're like, no, you go. And sometimes it's like, no, you're causing a problem by waiting for me to go. Just go and I'll find my place.
Yeah.
So my philosophy lately is I just ignore everybody else.
This all sounds like the last sex party I went to.
I don't want to know how.
Pretty much everything you just described, only it wasn't in Vietnam.
That was the only difference.
I can't afford a ticket just for a sex party. I mean, Richmond exists.
Well, I'm glad to know they're not that great then.
Yeah. Well, the traffic. So, yeah, I've heard that in some places. When I was in New York City, I noticed that it was kind of like that. I mean,
what I was trying to say is just don't even, don't give yourself too much credit for being great or being generous or anything. And don't suppose too much that the person who cut you off is a jerk.
Right.
Like, everybody's just trying to get where they're going in giant metal machines. So just try not to take it so personally or think you're so great because you let somebody in front of you. Just drive and
you are.
Let them in if it's convenient, and don't be like, why, of course, my dear sir, or whatever. Just like,
I am a traffic philanthropist. I give you this place in front of me of my own free will. I'm going to write it off my taxes, as a matter of fact. I let three people in yesterday.
Exactly. I swear there's people keeping those kinds of tallies. So anyway, just don't think you're so great when it comes to driving.
Well, you notice
or anybody else is so bad.
When you're in a hurry, everyone is infuriating because they're not in a hurry. When you're not in a hurry, everybody around you, you're like, why are people in such a rush? I am just enjoying my day. It's a really strange psychological thing. It's why I walk as much as possible.
Right.
Like 40,000 people a year die in car accidents, and people won't fly, even though you'd have to fly 38,000 years to make yourself statistically likely to die in a plane crash. That's true, by the way. That's the actual statistic. But 40,000 people a year die in car accidents.
Is it also true, or just hearsay, that I've heard that you're more likely to win the lottery than to die in a plane wreck?
Well,
something like that.
Like 38,000 years wasn't a joke. It ends up being like 0.000075 or something. I'm not a mathematician, as we all know.
So anyway, yeah, walk more, right? I walked here, and I'm pretty proud of myself, and I think everyone else should be pretty proud of me too.
We all are. We're having a party later for Mick walking to the studio. We had a cake made and everything.
By the way, could I get a ride home? Or
I walked. I mean, I got dropped off. I'm going to be walking to my office to advise people who have waited till this point to sign up for summer classes. Can you tell us the end of the semester? And I'm a little bit cynical. It's the only time of the year, only time in my entire life I get cynical, is this time of year. Yeah, the grades.
The lies keep coming. Anyway, Leif Erickson's here. Leif, you do all kinds of stuff. You're a writer. You're a thespian. I don't know if I can say thespian on the air.
I think that since the laws have changed, you can. There's an island of Thespos that all thespians are from, actually. But yes, I'm thespianing as we speak. That would be wrong.
Kind of, though. I mean, all the time, really.
Tonight, actually, I'm going to be over at Ward Hall in Georgetown. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. It's an antebellum. You know, bellum means war. Ante means before, not anti, which is against. Antebellum plantation mansion.
And so whenever the term, which is one of my favorite terms to throw around, whenever that gets thrown around, what it means is didn't get burned down. Is that kind of what it means?
Yeah, I mean, it survived. The Civil War. Yeah, it survived the Civil War. There are so few things that survived all that carnage that is one of the places that did.
And that's our educational tip for our listeners this morning is antebellum. Go out and use it. It means didn't get burned down during the Civil War.
Exactly. You know, ante is why you put the money in a poker hand before, A-N-T-E.
Look at that.
Learning today. If we were in the classroom, I'd write this on the board and say, this is free. I'm not going to charge you for this. I'm in a play, The Cherry Orchard, that we're performing there. But this will be our first night actually in the space, so we're pretty excited.
Now, The Cherry Orchard is both the title of the play and you're playing in a cherry orchard? Or?
I'm playing a tree, kind of like in To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, she played a ham. I'm playing a tree. I'm going to get attacked in a forest on the way. It's really a sordid play. It's a rewriting of Anton Chekhov's Cherry Orchard, starring chipmunks and naked people.
So it's a sordid place.
We did sordid things. No, it's actually just Cherry Orchard.
It's Chekhov.
Chekhov, yes. So not from Star Trek.
For those people who only think of Chekhov from Star Trek,
right.
How would you describe Chekhov the playwright
and his work? Enemy Wessel. That was for all you Trek nerds out there. It takes place in Russia in 1903, mm-hmm. and it involves, it's a long story how it came but...
But talk about, like, Chekhov, like, as a playwright, and what's the sort of the tone of his plays?
Dark. I mean, no, he has a lot of humor to his work, but it's dark humor usually.
Because he's Russian.
Right. Well, yeah, it was pretty bleak in the time in which he was writing. And that's kind of what the play focuses on, is how people are adjusting to a bunch of changes in Russia at this time. This is before the Russian Revolution. By a little over 10 years. But it's about 50 years after the peasants were set free in Russia, which was a great thing, of course, but which had all these effects on the economy and families. And it's a complex play, and that's Chekhov for you, just complex issues about existentialism and life and death. And he's a brilliant playwright. And, of course, this is a translation. This is an adaptation, which was adapted from several translations from Russian into English, mm-hmm. which is actually cool in a play because most plays you want to stick exactly to the script word for word. But since this is a translation, there's a little bit of wiggle room for the directors who actually compiled the adaptation, I believe, to really find what these characters are like and to incorporate that into the lines a little more. You don't have to be as restricted to the words on the page, which I'm glad to be restricted to when it's someone who's written something in English, so they want it word for word.
Right.
But when it's translated from Russian, obviously we're not doing it in Russian, so it gives you a little more freedom to interpret the lines.
We could even take, the whole world of translation, I think, is
it's fascinating.
Crazy.
Yeah, people don't realize
it's not mathematics. You know, just like this word to this word, this word to this word. And then when you get into poetry and stuff like that, I mean, mm-hmm. forget about it. But if you're talking about anybody who's a wordsmith and it's not English, they chose their words as carefully as you would if you were in English. And so it's not just like, change word A to word B.
Not at all. In fact, if Chekhov were here and watching any translation of his play, not just this one, he might cringe a few times.
Absolutely.
Because he'd
totally
be dead.
Missing.
So,
right.
That makes people cringe usually. It's an art. It's not a science. And actually it makes a difference when you're reading a book that's been translated. It makes a huge difference who translated it and what kind of work they put into it and how good of a translator they are, because it's not a word for word match. And it requires a lot of judgment and interpretation. And isn't this exciting, folks? The finer points of translation. No, I think it is pretty interesting, actually. But that's me. But it is an art.
So you guys are doing this tonight, right?
Well, we're moving into the space for the first time. We've been practicing at Arts Place downtown. In the basement. Now, that's an interesting building right there. I don't know if you folks have been in Arts Place, but if you have, go down in the basement. There's a lot of studios down there for artists and things, and it was built as a YMCA, I think,
in
1908.
He's trying to trick you. Never go into the basement at Arts Place.
That's true. You never come out. It's it's comfortable for a while. There's this one room that looks like something out of Saw. I wish I could.
That's such a charming thing to think.
It's a little room, and it says maintenance only. Keep out. And
there's blood splattered on the door.
Well, you know, almost. Somebody opened it the other day, and it's this tiny room with old brick and cinder block, and it has like a pipe coming out of the wall with a rope tied to it. It makes me think someone was locked up in there. I asked our director if she was going to put us in there if we don't know our lines.
Like a broken handcuff.
You have to know your lines exactly. It's Saw, basically. If you get a word wrong, then they shock you. It's really rough, but we get paid, so you know. Everything's worth it if there's money involved. That's in the Bible.
So people that maybe perhaps still want to, the few people that still want to see this. This is the Cherry Orchard, by the way.
Right. The whole third act is in Esperanto. So come on over. I mean, it is translation after all.
Right.
No, actually, it's fantastic. It really is. The play itself is fantastic. And then the cast is overwhelmingly good. I have really a couple of small roles in it, but I get to go watch like this play come to life every mm-hmm. night with some really, really fine actors.
What's up with the location?
Well, this is called a site-specific play. I was in another one with this group, which is called On the Verge Productions, and I was in another one about 5 or 6 years ago called Another Part of the Forest by Lillian Hellman, who was Dashiell Hammett's significant other. And it took place at the Hunt Morgan House. Mm-hmm. And so you're right there. The audience sits in the room with the players, close enough as ghosts, as I put it one time, literally feet away. And they move. The audience moves rooms at various points in the play and even goes outside at one point mm-hmm. to witness what's going on. So it's kind of like you're a fly on the wall of an actual family going through actual things. And It's that kind of thing. I think the audience at first will be uncomfortable because they're sitting so close to people living their lives, because this play is so, the acting is so naturalistic. It's going to feel like people really living their lives. But I think after a few minutes, the audience will really warm to the whole setup. I mean, that's what happened last time, and people end up really, really loving it. It's a mm-hmm. lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to do. You know, you're actually in a house, and we dance, and we're doing waltzing. I have to dance. Now, that's... Ooh, that's interesting. I didn't know I was supposed to dance because I didn't look at the script closely enough. And I
can't wait for us to talk to Bree Lowry from the Kentucky Valley Theater
about this
dancer. In a few minutes.
Maybe I'll show her my waltzing and she will go home crying.
Right. She's going to be around to tell you, you know, what. Or we'll get some of the lowdown from that. Bree's coming on in a little bit to talk Kentucky Valley Theater. So, and we can maybe even talk also about what do you call the line between the audience and the stage, and how, you know,
the fourth wall,
and how theater and ballet have both.
That's
maybe
an interesting
done
question,
experiments at kind of breaking that.
Imagine like a hobbit that's been through an industrial accident dancing a waltz. That's what it looks like.
That's the next thing I was going to think of, actually.
My flat-footed hobbit-shaped body doing a waltz. Everybody, just imagine that for a moment, and you'll have your laugh for the morning. It'll give you a good start to your day.
We'll have some sort of diagram of that on the Trivial Thursdays Facebook page. This is Trivial Thursdays, by the way. It's 10 after 8 in the morning, and Leif Erickson and I are going to take a break. Coming up a little later in the show, Bree Lowry of the Kentucky Ballet Theater is going to be joining us. And in the meantime, I'm going to play something from Prince, and then when we come back, two middle-aged chubby white guys are going to talk about the legacy of Prince.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.
Trivial Thursdays here. Music from Prince back there from Artificial Age, which has been stuck in my ears lately as I continue to sort of pore over Prince's catalog, which I was not. I'll be honest, in so many ways, I was so ignorant of Prince's catalog,
me too,
of all kinds
yeah.
of stuff. I just took him for granted in this kind of way that I won't really apologize for. Like, he was ever present in my life, like mostly in the favorites world of people that I loved, you know, most, mm-hmm. a lot of women, but guys too. And so like, I sort of pondered, I walk around listening to like these Prince records and I'm like, this record is amazing. Yeah. And I didn't know it cause I never listened to it. I've only ever listened to Prince at like, I don't know, you know, like when I'm hanging out with friends or who want to listen to Prince, or we're having some kind of dance party or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, music is so amazing for sparking memories. Every time I hear the entrance to 1999, I think I was in middle school at boarding school, and Prince was, quote, illegal, so it was all, you know, dangerous to listen to it, but it was playing everywhere in the dorm, and it just brings back such good memories of that sort of youth, that being free kind of thing. I love Prince, and I'm like you. I didn't know his deep catalog at all. I knew his hits, basically, and I'm learning more and more of his music.
38 albums.
Yeah. that's a lot of albums.
Which even, I've read it twice now, and both times, like afterwards, like right now, I'm like, that can't be right. That must be false.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Bowie. I always loved Bowie, but I've been really just devouring Bowie's catalog since he died, and I knew, you know, a lot of his stuff, but even that, it's like, wow, why did it take him dying for me to really delve into it this deeply? It's a weird thing.
The Bowie catalog I was thoroughly familiar with, for the most part, until the latter stuff. But like, I've spent a lot of time lately comparing my trying to process Prince's death, because when Bowie died, I was kind of hit sort of hard by that, because I was an absolute personal acolyte, you know. I was mm-hmm. a huge fan, and I spent a lot of time with David Bowie, like with headphones on, or you know, and just me and David Bowie,
yeah.
as well as friends and stuff. But that wasn't the case with Prince. With Prince, it was much more of a social thing. And I'll be honest, I think I won't say you know dismissed is too strong of a word, but like I always thought of Prince in my mind as being like, I never would have listed him like in my top favorite people. And I always thought of him as maybe being, oh, well, you know, that's good for a good time. It's maybe kind of a little frivolous or something, or it's sort of party music or something like that. Mm-hmm. But listening to his catalog now, listening to records like Walking Around, or, you know, I've been doing a lot of walking and listening to stuff. So I listen really closely to the records, and, you know, I don't have, a lot of people out there are going, hello, because the records are sort of, they're amazing.
Yeah.
The lyrics are super deep, and all of it is couched in, so much of it is couched anyway, and this, it just, you know,
pop
legendary sort of dance grooves and
yeah.
pop and,
mm-hmm.
and incredible studio production. And so I keep thinking, I keep trying to figure out what it was, you know, if there's anything that I could bring to the table about, you know, for me personally to share that's worth sharing about Prince. And, you know, I come up with a few things, you know, but one of them is that Prince, strangely and almost counterintuitively enough, has been an incredible male role model,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I don't know if that's part of why women like him too, like sort of saying, dudes, you should be more like Prince.
Yeah.
Or not that everyone should be like Prince, but Prince's version of being a man.
Yeah. It runs counter to what we're told a lot about being a man, which is actually a bunch of insecurity. Like Prince was not afraid to let his feminine side, you know,
yep.
show, and to embrace it really, and to just say, this is who I am as a man. And like people like my father-in-law, he's very conservative. He's a music connoisseur. He collects records, plays guitar. He acknowledges that Prince was a brilliant guitarist, but he's very uncomfortable by Prince's masculinity. And he,
yeah.
you know, he insists that Prince was gay, which, you know, we wouldn't have a problem with, but he would. And I'm like, well, I don't think he was, though. I'm not that it matters, but I don't think he was either.
And I think it's yeah. significant sort
yeah.
of to the, again, like for men to,
yeah.
to see that, to, you know, to see that version
right.
of masculinity.
Well,
masculinity, but this is how to be a man on
yeah.
a certain level. You know, Prince was an incredible example of how to be a man.
Yeah, if you go around all the time insisting that you're a man and doing manly things to show
right.
people don't realize that actually shows an insecurity. I don't go around trying to prove that I'm an English professor. I am an English professor. Let me show you. I can lift this book. Like, it's like, that is what I am. So yeah. I don't have to prove it. I don't have to demonstrate it all the time. I can just be who I am. And that's, to me, that's one of the wonderful things about Prince. He just was who he was. And he's like, this is my version of masculinity. Right. And I love it. And I love who I am. And I agree. That's such a great role model.
And you know, and he left us a lot of music to ponder, you know, for people like me who didn't listen to enough of it.
Me too, yeah.
At the time, you know, I get to go back now. And like I said, you know, the track I played, Clouds from Artificial Age, which was one of his last records, which is called Art. It's three words, Artificial Age.
Nice.
And I only got I was like, once I, like, almost representative of everything I've been saying, I didn't get it until I listened to the record and just heard it come out of his mouth a couple times.
Yeah, George Orwell said that all art is propaganda. He even has an essay and a collection of essays titled that. And it's a provocative statement. We first want to recoil against it, but the original meaning of propaganda is just getting a message out. And what I love about both Bowie and Prince is the fact that they put all these really important things in their songs, but it did it with pop music. Like, people often can't write pop because it's hard to write a best-selling song.
And then to put your philosophy into it.
And when you can do both so well, it's just brilliance.
Really. Yeah, that's what I think a lot of people maybe. There are definitely people who misunderstand. Like, I'm fascinated forever by pop music and by the concept of trying to write a universal song.
Yeah.
You know, that's just wildly appealing to everyone. It has to follow a whole lot of rules that make it really hard. So people that say, well, all those songs sound the same. It's like, yeah, that's because you play with all the tiny little parameters of those to get it just right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do get it just right, you make an incredible song. And if you don't, then you make a song that's just like, oh, God, I'm so sick of hearing this song.
Yeah, not that I'm comparing myself to Prince at all, but one of the best...
One
of the best compliments that I ever get about my writing is that people recognize it as my writing before they know it's me. And that's a really great, gratifying thing. And so if you go, well, it all sounds alike, maybe it's because you're not into it, but there's a certain sound, it's true, that's associated with Prince or Bowie. But you can find a lot of versatility within that, quote, same sound. Mm-hmm. You know, if you listen, the brain doesn't pick up the differences in sounds right away anyway. You have to listen to something a while to really figure out the different layers and levels if they exist. So just listen to it more if you're out there thinking, all of Prince's stuff sounds the same. Listen a little closer, listen a little more, and you might start to differentiate those things.
I want to segue one thing in. I'm going to bring Bree Lowry in for this too, because I realize it's a good segue. But so the thing, I kept thinking about David Bowie and Prince, and the way I was like, they're so similar, but they're so different.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept kind of stacking things up. And I'm like, they're both, you know, sort of incredible auteurs who did lots of different things. They're both geniuses at playing a variety of instruments. They both, you know, this and that. But I realized that for me, David Bowie was such a, it was, me and David Bowie, like, could be, we didn't have to have kind of anybody else. It was all sort of in my brain, really. Like, I could sort of not have any friends and listen to David Bowie.
Isn't that the case?
Yeah, this is so cool. But Prince sort of demanded that you dance. And by doing so, like, he had more important things to tell you. He said, but first you have to dance. Because part of what I want to tell you is that you have to be connected to your body. And I thought that was, like, and I was uncomfortable with that. So that's part of why, like, I mostly only listen to Prince, like, you know, with friends at parties and stuff like that. Because, you know, if it was just me and Prince, awkward, maybe.
Yeah.
But that's what he did. He's like, no, you got to dance.
Yeah, and group dancing is the best with Prince.
You've got to dance, and then the messages can come through. They can come through once you shake it out a little bit.
And it's great because you don't mind dancing even if you're terrible at it. When you're listening to Prince, I don't even mind dancing. And I've told you the Hobbit thing about me dancing. But when you're dancing to Prince, you kind of lose that inhibition. And especially if you're in a group of people who are also losing that inhibition. It's a wonderful thing. Our friend Lori Houlihan had that Prince party not long after he passed away and went over for that. And it was just an amazing thing to be dancing with all those people who are also dancing to Prince. Do you dance to Prince, Bree?
I do.
Bree Lowry's here. Bree is a professional dancer. Hi, Bree.
Hello,
it's always great
to
see you. And we were talking a little bit, but I just thought I'd pull you in because, you know, like I said, you guys, you and the Kentucky Ballet Theater dance and perform for people.
Thousands.
You are, as I say, dancing machines.
Yes.
But also, I have to assume, champion on some level dance as a personal thing that everyone maybe should have.
Absolutely.
In their lives.
And I want to circle back to something you said, you know, just you and Prince. It's art. Shouldn't it make you uncomfortable to some degree? You know, and then Prince breaks down the inhibition with his voice and the musicality, and then everything's okay. So he takes that first step for you. You know, art and music and dance should make you uncomfortable or make you think or really make you conscious of exactly where you are in the space-time continuum. So you kind of want to – it's a good thing. And then people warm up to it. And then once Prince really gets into his chorus or the – The verses, people are there and present with him. So they've, through music, through something they hear and don't see, they're able to really take a step artistically, whether they think about it that way or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. I'm glad to hear you say that. I try to get across to my students. I'm an English professor, and like, you have to take a risk with your writing. You have to provoke somebody somewhere. Otherwise, why are you even doing it?
Yes.
Art should make you uncomfortable. The brain is lazy and doesn't want to change, doesn't want to learn. And so you have to kind of provoke the brain to get up and roust it out of bed and be like, hey, what are you doing? And that's what art is good for. You can provoke in a lot of ways, even with ballet, I'm sure.
That's what Prince was good at, though. You know, the brain is lazy and likes what it likes. And then you throw in a weird beat. Or you throw in an unusual lyric that you don't know if it's a girl or a guy singing, you have to think about it. You focus on it. It draws your attention. If you're in your car, whether you're at a party with friends, wherever. And
then he added the extra thing where he's like, oh, by the way, you have to move your body.
Yes.
And you're like, no, don't make me do that. Can I just sit here and listen to this on headphones?
I just think about how it would have been if Prince had anything to do with the movie Footloose.
It might have been good. Is that what you're thinking? Which version, by the way?
The original. Oh, okay. You know, they didn't, people don't like dancing, and there are groups that are completely against it for many reasons. And it's tough, you know, it's a natural body motion. And at this point, with the Zumba and the fitness craze, Prince is everywhere. The gym, the grocery store,
yeah.
On your iPad while you're running. I mean, it's everywhere.
So. Yeah, I went to a Baptist boarding school, and we were not allowed to dance. Even in the late 80s when I was there, and I taught there in the late 90s, still students weren't allowed to dance. And we pointed out that David danced before the Lord in the Bible, and that didn't seem to help. You could actually get in a lot of trouble just for dancing, which is, you know, it's an expressive form of human art and emotion. I mean,
it's the most basic form of human communication.
Right.
So it's a way to work. One dancer, we all move. You know, movement is the universal language. And people forget that sometimes because they're so wrapped up in their own ideologies. And it takes icons like Prince, like the Beatles, like David Bowie, who say, you know what? Get up and move and listen and be engaged and mm-hmm. see where it takes you.
Yeah, I'm amazed at the number of people who seem to communicate that art is about being conventional. Don't step outside the boundaries. And it's like, that's the last thing you should be conventional with. I tell my students, like, no one ever said, I loved that book. It was so conventional. It was so done like every other book. And yet that we encourage people when we're teaching art to really just play it safe and phone it in. I have a question. Could you do ballet to Prince, or are there strict rules about what music you can do ballet
to? No, you
can
do ballet to everything.
Ballet to basketball.
Yes. Kentucky Ballet Theater does ballets to bouncing basketballs for rhythm. I'm totally serious.
It's true. Cool. I've seen it.
Yes.
Nice.
But actually, Prince discovered Misty Copeland, which is kind of one of the unsung heroic stories of him that started to come out. She is one of the most famous black ballerinas in recent past. There have been many before her, but Prince discovered her. He called her up in 2006 or 7 and said, Misty, you know, I think you're really talented. I want you to come perform with me. And she danced in her pointe shoes on top of a piano while he was singing. And it was different and interesting. And they just released a Barbie of her this week. So it's really caught on. You know, it's important that people fuse the different kinds of art together. KBT has a really great program called the Urban Dancer Project, where we have costumes made by University of Kentucky students, and we are photographed in artistic places all over town. My photo was taken on a mural on one of the mural walls. We have girls who were photographed in the Pepper Distillery. You know, making art forces creativity, and anymore, you have to be outside the box. As the director of season planning and programming and educational programs, we go outside the box for the most benefit for the students. But you have to be so highly involved to look at it that way to really prove the most benefit.
I was wondering about that, if you had trouble with recruiting young people who might see ballet as kind of fusty and ancient and that.
Yeah, let's have the thespian and the ballerina talk about that.
Well,
both are challenged, I think.
It is, and it really depends. It also depends on the city that you're in. A program that sells well in New York City or Chicago will not sell well here. That being said, we have The Little Mermaid coming up in 2 weeks, and we had two shows that sold out in 2 days.
Wow.
Which is, we're praying for sellouts with walk-up crowds, and we sell out all of our Nutcrackers. We are now up to 3 full sold-out shows and have added a second one that there's only the top deck left at the Opera House. So a lot of it in this marketing community is the type of programming or the, for us, the, what story are we doing? Nutcracker, Little Mermaid, Cinderella. We have some that are more popular than others, but we've started introducing mixed bills, the ballet about basketball, some really intense neoclassical works that make you think, that are about fate and anxiety and all these different ideas. So to be able to have the super classical and the super exciting leaps of Jorge Barani coupled with ballets about fate and basketball, it's interesting, and it takes the audience on this whirlwind of emotional experiences while we're the individual dancer on the stage and they're the individual in their seat. So while you all talk, we have to do everything non-verbally, yeah, which is tough.
So let me ask you, if you had to compare ballet to another art form, what would it be closest to?
Oh, man.
That's an on-the-spot question, I know.
Probably an orchestra. Because
that's good, yeah.
Because there, you work so much on working in an ensemble and perfecting your craft for your own self. And then when you perform and you rehearse, you work in a group, or you work as a featured soloist, or, you know, there's a first chair violinist who's would be equivalent to the principal. The artistic director is equivocal to the conductor. You have a corps de ballet that could be the rest of the string section. That's probably the most direct connection, yeah. But it,
I think that's good, because I love, one of my favorite things to talk to you about Kentucky Valley Theater, mm-hmm, is kind of the mechanics in some ways, and how I feel like there's almost an essential, there's kind of this essential disconnect that I have, where like a lot of people don't, if you guys get it exactly right the way you're trying to get it, it actually comes across as almost like, I love seeing the kind of tiny flaws and watching the practices.
We hate
and
that.
Well, not necessarily in the big performance, but like, okay, I love it when you guys do this stuff where you invite the audience kind of, yes, into your space to see the incredible hard work that goes into it, and the just in many ways incomprehensible sort of coordination, not just of individual dancers, but of the entity as a whole, like you said, right, like an opera, I mean like an orchestra kind, right, of.
Yeah, well, that's the hard part about doing any group art, is you have to work on two levels. You've got to really perfect your own little space there, your own world, mm-hmm, and you have to be conscious all the time of what how your body is. This is the same with acting and dancing, I'm sure. How your body is, how you're breathing, if you're focusing on what your role is supposed to be. And then you have to be part of that ensemble too. You can't ignore the group dynamic. And you know, you have good actors sometimes who really have a hard time working in an ensemble because
you have
of
principal
that.
Dancers who have trouble with that too sometimes, because they are so programmed to be the soloist and stand out. It's difficult. Little Mermaid's going to be a treat for us because we'll all only have one character to play. We can be whatever character we need to. And don't forget that. So we have ensemble. Every head has to be the same way. Every arm has to be the same way. Every foot has to be pointed at the same time. And then you have characterizations. So in our show we did in March at Singletary, you know, we went from this intense ballet about fate to cheerleaders in basketball, in uniforms. Right. So it's stylistically for dancers, we have to totally convey that with our motion while we pay attention to all the other details. So
I'm curious. My daughter and I came to your dress rehearsal for where you guys were practicing the basketball thing at the, mm-hmm, Singletary Center, and we're sort of dress rehearsal fans of Kentucky Valley, yes, Theater, which we appreciate. It's just like sort of lurking in and kind of taking in part of it. It works really well with I'll just say my daughter, because then, you know, we're sort of free to come and go as,
yeah,
we please. But anyway, I thought one of the funny things when I was watching you all do this, the basketball ballet, is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
I
can't remember. It's called Hoops.
Hoops, yeah. And it's actually been around for a long time.
It has.
Right?
It's been done twice in 8 years. So it's a rare one to see. But
and so I was
special.
Trying to figure out if this was the dress rehearsal and you guys were all kind of wearing sweats and stuff. And I was like, are they actually wearing what they're going to wear or not?
And then the photos pop up of us in Henry Clay High School cheerleader outfit. Yeah.
Okay.
No, and the boys actually wore the basketball jerseys, and a couple of the boys have full sleeve tattoos. So they were legit basketball players, and I would really like to put Jorge Barani up against some of the UK 7-footers and see who can jump higher.
Well, that sounds kind of like a Harlem Globetrotters kind of thing.
Kind
because
of a
when
little
I was
bit.
A kid, I was like, nobody can beat the Harlem Globetrotters. No one can beat them. Because they're magic. Let's talk for a second about Jorge. I don't know if Leaf knows this or not. I mean, I always like to.
Sure.
It's always fun to sing the praises of Jorge Barani.
Jorge
because
Barani
he's internationally famous.
Has an Instagram following of 37,000 people. He defected from Cuba 3 years ago. Came to the United States. He was a star, and then he went to the National Ballet School there and was a star in the national company. Stayed behind on a tour. Got his butt to Miami and then called our director and said, my girlfriend and I are looking for jobs. Do you have anything? And we happened to be turning over the company that year. And he is an unmatched talent. People compare him to Baryshnikov. They compare him to some of the best stars in Russia. Mick actually has had one of his photos side by sided with Baryshnikov, and it looks identical.
Wow.
So it's... he's a super talent. He makes us all work harder because he's the kid in the studio who is a clown.
He's a clown. Goofball.
And then he gets into his performance mode and he does 10 pirouettes and the audience just can't even believe it. I have a photo of Nutcracker and you can see six people standing underneath of him for how high he is off the ground. And it's a Prince-like idea where it's a super talent where they make you uncomfortable and they're so good that you're kind of like a little standoffish. It's an unusual space to be in. You're like, this is just a normal human being. Why can he do this? He's 5'4".
So I that brings a question up to me, and maybe it's unanswerable, but if you've been in this a while, you might know, like, what differentiates? Some people seem to be born for dance. Their bodies seem to be made for that. Is there a certain quality? I mean, I that's too open-ended a question.
It's pretty open. The best way I can describe it is you have to have the right body. People can love it and do it their whole life and have a sincere art appreciation. But when it comes down to it, you really need to be shaped a certain way, boy or girl.
Look at me that way? I know I'm not the right shape. I mean, you know.
But at the same time, you know, not everybody is one shape. Or one idea. There's a lot of different how your body processes the movement, how it looks on your body, how you adapt to it. Most of it's mental. Ballet dancers are very bright people. We think about 17,000 things at once. So it's a mind-body balance. And it's hot in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's too hot, get out. We're very naturally competitive. We are the kind of people who say, if I do it 3 more times, it will get better and I will perform better. So we're almost like ruthless pragmatists a little bit. Coupled by we have this brain capacity to remember choreography, muscle memory, internal core strength, emotional strength when you get your butt kicked in rehearsal and you want to go home and cry. You don't cry in the studio. You know, it takes an athlete. It takes a visionary, a broad thinker. We work backwards. You know, we put the music in our body and the choreography in our body, and then we work backwards and perfect every little thing. So it's a personality type as well. I say it's about 80% mental, 10% body, because you have the body you're born with. How you deal with your muscle tone is up to you. And then the last 10% is artistry. Mm-hmm. So it's all part and parcel together, and it's a special thing. And
it requires a lot of intelligence of a certain kind, too, because, you know, my students, for instance, think multitasking is an easy thing, whereas studies show that multitasking is really kind of a myth. But artists, you know, like dancers, learn it takes years and years and years of practice to handle all those variables at once. You were talking about all the things you have to think about while you're dancing. And it takes a lot. You can't just learn to juggle multiple variables easily, and it doesn't come naturally. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize about good art. You are trying to hold so many things in your head at the same time and make them all perfect at the same time, which is it's quite a feat for any art, really. And I would say dance, even though I can't do it, I can imagine it's especially so in dance, where you've got to control all these parts of your body at the same time and your face, what you're doing with your face and what you're communicating nonverbally. It sounds like a lot of work to me. I'm exhausted thinking about it. There's a couch over here. I'll be back.
Right.
I'm going to lie down for a little bit.
Now, and I mean, just to underscore all that, or not really, probably to give it less gravity. But, you know, I like to use the term dancing machine because, you know, and it's not really intended tongue in cheek that much because I've seen you all be able to reproduce it. Yes. A lot of it has to do with reproducing. And I say this as a photographer, like anyone can take a great picture, but can you consistently take great pictures, you know? And with a lot of the training that you all do and the preparation that you all do for any kind of production, it comes down to rigor. There's an incredible rigor, and not I might be able to jump up kind of high one time, but I'm not going to be able to do it two or three more times.
25 times over until you think it's perfect.
Exactly.
And it's passable.
And just keep going.
Art is about
doing
that thing that most people can't do, but not only doing it, but getting to the point where it's just routine, where that's what I do, is this complicated thing that people wish they could do. I mean, that's a true artist, somebody that can just do that on command. You know, it's that... Art is spontaneous by nature, but an artist has to learn to call up spontaneity in the moment. It's a really complicated
thing. Else that's very interesting that I think people who are artists kind of pass by, and I see this in my daily life because I have a completely separate double life that I lead that's interesting, unusual. People sometimes think way down the line in the future. Ballet dancers are completely in the moment. We live in the moment. We make or break our lives in the moment on stage. Maybe one moment you're flying across the floor and you feel amazing, and then the next moment you're on your butt. Mm-hmm. You know, and so to live in the moment is a tough, it's hard to sometimes acculturate with everybody else because we're so focused and so intense about that one moment and that one second and that one opportunity. And then you go home and you have people who want to talk about getting married or having a family, and we're mentally still in the studio because it's so consuming. I mean, we're married to our jobs, and people are always so shocked to meet us in public and find out how normal we are. and I'm serious. And we actually have started some new programs with the company, like Ballet Up Close and Personal. That'll be back next year.
That's the one where you do the thing in the studio and the audience is right there.
The Downtown Arts Center.
Oh, that's right.
Where you can be this close to us on stage. It's almost like a site-specific work, but it's a special time because people see us breathing. They understand that from the proscenium, we're these creatures that just move around flawlessly and spin on our toes and all these ethereal beings. And then they see us up close and we're breathing really heavy, and you watch how our eyes move when we're communicating on stage, and it's cool.
And then you're athletes, among other things. Yeah.
But one of the beautiful things about art, including dance, is that moment, because I think the reason that is because really it's always this moment. It's always been this moment. It just shifts around. And when we're thinking about those things like getting married or whatever in the future, that's sort of what we are taught, because we grow up thinking you need to plan, and planning's important, sure, whatever. But it's kind of an illusion. Because all you have is right now, not to be too philosophical, but and art lets you tap into that and lets you really rest in that. It's kind of a meditation kind of thing where I'm focusing on this moment and I'm putting all my energy into this art. And so all those things, all that planning, all the past is a ghost, the future's a rumor. So we instead of thinking of that stuff, we're focusing on what actually exists. Because we're always at the prow of the ship moving forward. We're always at that spot. It just feels like it's changing because we are not used to that concept, but we're in this moment, and it's all that exists.
And as a ballerina, we are in the moment, but I was teaching on Monday my 8-year-olds, and I said, look, you guys, you got to be 2 ideas ahead. So when you're doing this particular motion, you need to be thinking 2 steps ahead so that you're ready. And we don't so we want to be present in that moment, but we're already 2 steps ahead.
Well, the irony is you planning ahead is you being in that moment.
Yes.
Like, that kind of planning is part of being in the moment. You know, we just lose sight of it when we think that the plans we're making are the point, whereas the being in that moment is the point. And sometimes in that moment, it is important to think of other things outside. It's a complicated thing.
I just want to say, since we're talking about profound, ironic things, heavy art things, can we talk about Jorge Barani in a lobster costume?
Because it's hilarious. It's a funny thing you'll see all day.
I posted on the Trivial Thursdays Facebook page and on my page, too, a video that Jorge posted to his 37,000 followers, or is that what it was?
Yes.
Of Jorge doing, what do you call him, pirouettes?
Pirouettes. Yeah. And he is not a lobster. He's the prince in this particular ballet.
Oh,
but
he just decided to put the lobster costume on.
Well, we got the lobster costumes in
Rocky
to
lobster.
The studio, and he had on red tights. And I said, Jorge, you have got to put the lobster hat on and do some turns. Even he has claws, so you should probably find it.
Which
you should
snips.
Probably watch it, which he snips.
Yeah, just check out the Trivial Thursdays Facebook page. It's there. Or he's a Barani Ballet, I think. Ballet Barani.
Chase him with butter next time he's in a lobster costume. That's what I would do.
I tell you what, we're going to take a little musical break,